Hey, hey, it's your girl KV.
And Celine.
And we are back with another episode of the Hood Health Report. Today we are going to talk about some Black pioneers of public health and just the great things that Black people have done in this field to advance medicine, technology, our lifespans, all of the things. So Celine is going to start us off.
Yes, so I'm going to start with Charles Richmond Drew.
Oh, who said that? Who
said it? So I'm going to be talking about Charles Richmond Drew. He's known as the father of the blood bank, and he was born June 3rd, 1904. He lived to the age of 46. He passed away April 1st, 1950, and he left a huge impact on the public health field. He was a renowned surgeon, and he was a pioneer for the preservation of life-saving blood plasma. He broke many barriers in the racially divided America and became one of the most important scientists of the 20th century. His pioneer research and systematic developments in the use of preservation of blood plasma during World War II not only saved thousands of lives, but he innovated the nation's blood banking process. American Red Cross even adapted some of his standardized procedures and long-term blood preservation and storage techniques. So a little background so you understand a little bit better what plasma is. Plasma is like a clear yellowish liquid that contains proteins and electrolytes that carry blood through the cells and other substances through the body. It can be used as a blood substitute and to help fluids and treat shock. There are some advantages to using plasma over blood in emergency situations. You can keep it longer without refrigeration. It won't deteriorate. And then the blood, you can use it with any blood type. It doesn't transmit as many diseases. You can inject it into the veins, the muscles, skin. So you don't necessarily have to worry about where you're injecting it. A little bit background about Drew and why I decided to pick him. Drew was an average student, but he was a really gifted athlete. I kind of related because I was an athlete too. He did football and track and field, and he was on a scholarship to Amherst College in Massachusetts. He was one of 13 African Americans in the student body of 600, and it was during a racial climate that exposed hostility for the opposing teams. His own football team passed on him being like even the captain his senior year. Beyond sports, he didn't really have a clear direction of what he wanted to do. He just knew that he liked biology and that it kind of like piqued his interest in medicine. Like other fields at the time, they were all segregated, so he wasn't really sure where his education would take him. Okay, so after him going to college, the road led him to go to McGill University College of Medicine. It was in Montreal, and therefore he was distinguished himself by winning an annual scholarship and a prize for the neuroanatomy and became elected the Medical Honor Society of Alpha Omega Alpha. And he was on the medical staffing journaling committee. He also had some other accomplishments that he accomplished throughout that time period. He had an interest in the transfusion medicine and began during his internship and his surgical residency at the Montreal Hospital. He aspired to do transfusions therapy at the Mayo Clinic, but since it was so racially prejudiced at that time, there was a lot of like backlash about him wanting to do things like that. So he ended up going to Howard University College of Medicine, and he started with the pathology instructor there. And he helped them for a little bit of time. After that, he got his doctorate from Columbia University. Drew also won a fellowship to train at a hospital in New York with a surgeon named Alan Whipple. Usually at this time, you would go from, like, the traditional path would be you work a little bit with Whipple. So I guess what I'm trying to say is you would work under him, but Whipple instead decided to assign him to another person, which was named Strutter, and he saw him as, you know, a prestige and great, naturally great and a bright pupil. So together they did some research and they started doing stuff with shock and fluid balance and blood chemistry. And that's when he started on the banked bloods, and that was a study that they did from Columbia. He had his thesis, which was coined a masterpiece, and then his key findings was a complex procedure and standards for collecting and processing and storing blood that proved his expertise in an appointment to head the BFB, which is the Blood for Britain project, and that was the effort to transfer desperately needed blood and plasma to Great Britain when Germany was attacking them. In the midst of the BFB, which is the Blood for Britain project, Drew passed his American Board of Surgery exams, and Drew later returned to Howard briefly, but was called back to continue working on the BFB program. And when the program ended in 1941, the BFB collected 4,556 blood donations and shipped them. So, like, that was the start of Red Cross. Over 5,000 liters of plasma saline solutions to England. The program became known as Red Cross, and that was the pilot program for mass production of dry plasma in New York, and that was in 1941. With Drew as an assistant director and later the National Blood Donor Service, along with his other innovations, which was the blood mobiles, so the mobile of blood donation trucks that carry refrigerated plasma throughout states. And that's the reason why he earned the name as the father of the blood bank. Ironically, though, throughout that time period, Red Cross excluded African Americans from being able to donate, which made him ineligible to even, you know, do what he had put his life works towards. The policy was later modified to accept these donations, but blacks, however, were still, like, segregated. Their blood was segregated, which throughout the war, Drew openly criticized and also said that it was unscientific and insulting to African Americans. In October of 1941, Drew returned to Howard University, where he remained for the next 9 years, serving as the head of the Department of the Surgery and Chief of Surgery at the Freeman's Hospital. His mission was to train young African-American surgeons who would need to meet the rigorous standards of any surgical specialty. And also, he just wanted to be able to provide that tradition of excellence. He believed that this would be his greatest and most lasting contribution to medicine. He also campaigned against the exclusion of black African Americans, or I don't even know why I said it like that. He campaigned against the exclusion of black physicians from local medical societies because he felt like everybody should have the opportunity to, you know, practice medicine. His passing was very tragic. He was on his way back from North Carolina on April 1st, 1950. After falling asleep while driving to a conference, he was given a blood transfusion at the hospital, but he didn't survive. So his passing was kind of like, he still had a lot of things I feel like he had to offer to us.
Yeah, as much as I, you know, had heard about Charles Drew throughout life and, you know, public health, I never knew that he died tragically and at such a young age. Mm-hmm. I never knew that.
Yeah.
I know that I can remember, like, them saying he needed a blood transfusion. Mm-hmm. So it was like, you know, the irony of his life work, you know, not being able to save him because, you know, still needed some advancements to be made. But I never knew he died so young.
Yeah.
My first black public health pioneer will be William Augustus Hinton. He created a test for syphilis. So although William Augustus Hinton was born to formerly enslaved people, he went on to lead a very fulfilling life. He was awarded his bachelor's and his medical degree from Harvard University, which trained him to go on to be a bacteriologist, pathologist, and educator. Between college and medical school, he worked as an instructor at Walden University in Nashville, Tennessee. the Agriculture and Mechanical College in Langston, Oklahoma, and Meharry Medical College. Upon graduating from Harvard Med, he was met with much criticism and racism and was actually barred from becoming a surgeon because they didn't allow him in the Boston area hospitals. So, you know, like you said with Charles Drew, that racism still played a part in how they were able to function and do their life's work because he wanted to be a surgeon. Mm-hmm. So instead, he had to take a volunteer position at Wasserman Laboratory, which is like, you know, you have to be so passionate. You finish medical school and you think you're about to be a doctor, and then you can't even get a job because they won't allow you in the hospital. So you go to volunteer mm-hmm. and do work in a lab. So, you know, he was clearly very dedicated to what he was doing. So in that position, he became well-versed in serologic techniques and the testing of syphilis. He performed autopsies on persons who passed of syphilis and conducted research in the process. This work led to the development of a less painful syphilis detection test that was more efficient and more accurate than the previous test. This test was later adopted by the U.S. Public Health Services. He eventually became assistant director of the Massachusetts Division of Biologic Labs and the chief of the Wasserman Lab, which he, you know, initially volunteered at. Mm-hmm. He served in these positions for 38 years, and now that lab, that building is named after him. He was also the first black person to be promoted to the position of professor at his alma mater, Harvard University. So he first was an instructor, then he was like an assistant instructor, and then he became a professor, first black person. And he was also the first black writer to author and publish a medical textbook. So he had a lot of advancements in his life and also was able to, you know, create a test that wasn't so painful, because the previous test for syphilis, wasn't it like a spinal tap or something like that? It was just something that was very, very rough on the body. So him coming up with a better way to do that was definitely a huge advancement in public health.
Okay, so the next person I'm going to talk about is Mary Beatrice Davison Kenner. She was a self-taught inventor who created a sanitary belt, and she also filed 5 patents in her lifetime. The reason why I chose her was because most scientific heroes and geniuses that we learn about are men. You don't really hear about a lot of black women being like inventors and stuff like that, especially throughout her time period. She was born in 1912, and she lived to be 96 years old. She passed away in 2006. She was credited with creating the sanitary or menstrual belt, and she also filed, like I said, 5 patents. By the age of 6, she had already had like an inventor's mind, some would say. She used to have trouble sleeping as a child, so her mom would get up to go to work, and she would hear her mom like leaving because the door would like squeak. And she would tell her mom, hey, I think we need to invent, or you need to make something to stop that noise, like a self-oiling hinge door. And at the time, nobody had ever thought about it, so she was just making, like, creating stuff. They said that she also had that in her, like, bloodline for creating things. Her grandfather on her mother's side invented the tricolor light signal to guide trains, and her sister also invented a family board game that was patented, and then it became sold commercially. Around 1914, her father patented his clothes presser that could fit in a suitcase, and you could press trousers while you were en route to go somewhere. He turned down a New York company's $20,000 offer in a favor to attempt to manufacture and sell this product. As a result, it kind of turned out bad for him. I mean, at the time, he probably just felt like his invention was worth so much more. But because he didn't take that offer, he failed, and he only produced that single presser, and it was sold for $14. And it kind of like, you would have thought that would have deterred her from wanting to be an inventor, like seeing how her father had came up with something so great, and he wasn't even allowed to, like, you know, really profit off of it. But that didn't really deter her. As a child, she spent a lot of her time like drawing up and building building things. She thought about creating like a convertible roof for that could go over a car that could pull over, you know, things that we have now that we just wouldn't have ever thought that people didn't have back then. She also thought about like an umbrella that had like a sponge on it so that way it could absorb the water instead of, you know, how our umbrellas are today. The family moved to D.C. in 1924, and she would just go to the United States Patent and Trademark Office and, like, walk around and make sure that nobody had, like, filed patents for these ideas that she had created. And at the time, nobody had filed, like, any of the patents for the things that she wanted to create, so she was, like, really excited about that. And it just continued to help her, like, keep that innovative mind. In 1931, she graduated from high school, and she earned a place at Howard University, but she was forced to drop out a year and a half into her courses due to, like, financial pressures of the time. So then she just started taking, like, odd jobs, such as, like, babysitting, and before she landed a position as a federal employee. Throughout the time, she continued to, like, invent things. However, the main problem with her inventing things was she just didn't have the money at the time to file a patent, and at the time, it was too expensive for her to be able to do those things. So by the time it was 1957, she had saved enough money to buy her first ever patent, which was for a belt of sanitary napkins, and it was long before the invention of, like the disposable pads that we use now, and the women were still, like, using, like, cloth pads and rags at the time to, like, soak up, you know, period blood, and she thought that this would be helpful because then it could stop the leaks and stains that people were getting in their clothes. She was contacted by a company that expressed interest in the marketing idea of her sanitary belt, and she was so excited about it. She just knew that, like, this idea that she had would be so helpful to so many women. However, when they realized that she was Black, they no longer wanted to be interested in the product. She continued to invent stuff throughout her adult life. She even filed 5 other patents, and she's the only African-American woman in history to do that. She also created a walker that was inspired by her sister because she had developed multiple sclerosis. And then she also made other things to help her. So she made, like, with the walker, she made a tray that could attach to the walker so that way she could have her food readily available. And she also put pockets on it so that way she could be able to put stuff in it. She also created a back cleaner in the shower that way she could wash her back in the shower. Those hard to reach places. She never received her college degree or any professional training, and she never became rich off of any of her inventions. Then also another thing is, even with the patent for the sanitary belt, what they ended up doing was they waited until it was no longer active, and then they took the idea, and then they started mass producing disposable pads.
Of course they did.
Yeah.
That's what I thought she was going to say when her dad, with the clothes presser, like, oh, they made an iron after he, you know, refused them.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next person is Marilyn Hughes Gaston, and she worked with sickle cell. She was very pivotal in sickle cell advancements. So Marilyn Hughes Gaston was born to a family that was economically disadvantaged and resided in public housing. Her passion to be a doctor began at age 9 due to her mother's health complications. They said her mother had, I think it was cervical cancer, and her mom would have these fainting spells. So she kind of noticed that and knew that her mom wasn't insured. They didn't have any insurance because they were poor. And so she really took a liking to, well, I need to do something to, you know, be a doctor, help people that don't have insurance, things of that nature. So although she knew from a young age that she wanted to practice medicine, she ended up studying zoology at the University of Miami in Ohio due to resistance and the racism of others. So trying to be pre-med, she had a lot of racist views on her, like, oh, nobody wants a Black doctor. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants a Black woman trying to treat them. So she kind of took that to heart and didn't even major in pre-med. She eventually, though, ended up in medical school at the University of Cincinnati in 1964. And she was only one of six black women to graduate that year. While working as an intern at Philadelphia General Hospital, Gaston had to treat a baby with a swollen hand, but no signs of trauma. So this confused her because she, you know, was wondering, how did this baby get this swollen hand if they didn't injure themselves? And her supervisor was like, well, test the baby for sickle cell. Hmm. She didn't really know about sickle cell, so she was very interested in, you know, seeing how it could affect this child in this way. So this was a very pivotal moment in her career. She realized, like I said, she realized that never occurred to her that the baby had sickle cell, and she became enthralled with learning everything about sickle cell. She secured several federal grants to study about sickle cell disease, and in 1986, one of her studies led to groundbreaking findings that led to a national sickle cell disease screening program for newborns. In addition to the screening program, her research also found that penicillin was an effective drug in preventing infection from sepsis, which in turn has resulted in a significant reduction of morbidity and mortality in young children with sickle cell disease. This eventually led to her sickle cell disease screening tests being used on babies nationwide. I think at first, like, the major stepping stone, the major step was 40 states had adopted it, mm-hmm. but eventually all of the states adopted it and was using her screening tests. In 1990, Gaston became the first black female physician to be appointed director of the Health Resources and Services Administration's Bureau of Primary Health Care. In this position, she controlled a $5 billion budget and served 12 million patients, most of whom were economically disadvantaged, which was one of her lifetime goals. She was also the second black woman to serve as Assistant Surgeon General, as well as achieve the rank of Rear Admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service. She is very awarded in the public health world, and they named many scholarships after her at her alma mater, and she even has a day in her honor in her hometown.
It's crazy, like, to think about how earlier on they didn't really test for certain things, and now that we do those tests so regularly that mm-hmm. you don't even think about it, but mm-hmm. yeah.
Because she didn't even know enough about mm-hmm. sickle cell disease to even think of that as an option mm-hmm. for why this baby came in with a swollen hand, so... You know, it's interesting to see what wasn't necessarily deemed important
yeah.
back in the days, and also how they treated black people trying yeah. to practice medicine
in general.
Yeah, and this wasn't even that long yeah. ago.
Yeah.
So, like, she's still
alive. Yeah.
So it's amazing to be like, wow, like, she was doing all this advancements in 86. I was born in 89, and she was facing pushback then yeah. on being a black woman doctor. So, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of black doctors, my next person is Joycelyn Elders. Her first name is Minnie, but she just goes by Joycelyn Elders. She was born in 1933, and in 1978, she became the first person in the state of Arkansas to become a board-certified pediatric endocrinologist. She was the 15th Surgeon General of the United States as well, and the first African American and only the second woman to head the U.S. Public Service, U.S. Public Health Service. She was an outspoken advocate for public health. She was appointed the Surgeon General by President Clinton in 1993. She was born to a poor farming parents. She grew up in rural and segregated, poverty-stricken pocket of Arkansas. She was the eldest of eight children, and her and her siblings had to combine work with them working in, like, cotton fields. So from the age of five all the way up until she went off to go to school, she would have to go 13 miles from home to go to school because it was segregated at the time. And she would often have to miss school because when it was harvest time, she would have to be picking cotton and helping with her family to help support them. So most months from September through December, she didn't even attend school throughout her younger years. After graduating high school, she earned a scholarship to an all-black liberal arts school in Little Rock. After college, she joined the Army and she trained in physical therapy in Houston, Texas. And then after she was discharged in 1956, she enrolled at the University of Arkansas. It was a medical school and she did it off of her GI Bill. Although the Supreme Court had declared separate but equal education unconstitutional 2 years earlier, elders were still required to be in a segregated area during in the dining room, and she often ate with like the cleaning staff on the site. She did an internship in pediatrics at the University of Minnesota, and in 1961, she returned to the University of Arkansas for her residency. She became a chief resident, and she was in charge of an all-white, all-male residence and interns, which was also very interesting because at the time, they weren't expecting her to be able to do that. She earned her master's degree in biochemistry in 1967 and became an assistant professor of pediatrics at the university's medical school in 1971. She was a full professor by 1976. And then over the next 20 years, she published over 100 papers, most of them dealing with problems of the growth in juveniles with diabetes. This work led to her study of sexual behavior and also her advocacy on the behalf of health risks that happen when people become pregnant too young. She helped patients to control their fertility and advised them on the safest times to start families. The governor at the time, Bill Clinton, appointed Joycelyn Elders to be the head of the Arkansas Department of Health in 1987. As she campaigned for clinics to expand the sex education, she caused a storm of controversy throughout that time period, and she also wanted to expand sex education. And it was kind of hard because a lot of people are conservative in the South, so they were not really big on her saying that she wanted to provide sex education to everybody, but she wanted them to mandate a curriculum for K through 12th grade that included sex education, substance abuse prevention, and programs to promote promote health and self-esteem. And she also got that passed in 1989. From 1987 to 1992, she nearly doubled the childhood immunization and expanded the state's prenatal care program and increased home care options for people who were chronically and terminally ill. In 1993, President Clinton appointed her as the U.S. Surgeon General, despite opposition from conservatives. She was confirmed and sworn in September 10th, 1993. During her 15 months in office, she faced a lot of skepticism regarding her progressive at the time. I guess it's progressive back then. Her progressive policies about sexual education. Dr. Elders left the office in 1994, and she returned in 1995 to the University of Arkansas as a faculty researcher and professor of pediatric endocrinology at the university's at the Arkansas Children's Hospital. And then in 1996, she wrote an autobiography, and it just showcased her life from a sharecropper all the way up to becoming the Surgeon General of the United States. She retired from practice, but she continued to be a professor all the way up until like 2015 at the University of Arkansas School of Medicine, and she is now 90 years old.
And lastly, I'm going to talk about Otis Boykin, who invented the pacemaker. So Otis Boykin is different from the others that we've mentioned today because he did not directly work in the field of public health or medicine. He actually worked in the technology field. So he went to college at Fisk University, and he also did work in an aerospace lab in Nashville as a lab assistant testing automatic controls for aircrafts. After undergrad, he worked as a lab assistant for Majestic Radio and TTV Corporations as a supervisor and at PJ Nielsen Research Lab. Later, Otis pursued graduate studies at the Illinois Institute of Technology. However, he had to drop out because he and his family could no longer afford the tuition. But this did not stop him from going on to patent 28 electronic devices and briefly running his own tech company. In 1959, Boykin developed wire precision resistors for electronic components that made the production of televisions, computers, and radios much more affordable. 2 years later, he created a device that could withstand extreme changes in temperature and pressure, and the U.S. military later used this invention for guided missiles and the IBM computers. He also had a number of inventions such as burglar-proof cash registers and a chemical air filter. But he is most known for improving the pacemaker, which uses electrical impulses to help maintain a regular heartbeat. His works made the pacemaker much more precise. Due to these many tech achievements, he also worked as a consultant in the U.S. and in Paris. So that's all for the main people that we want to talk about today. But I also wanted to do an honorable mention of W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm. Because although he didn't directly work in, you know, the field of public health, he helped to shed light on racial disparities and injustices. And that, as we know, very much, you know,
open
the doors for more equality, for Black people to be treated more equal and things of that nature. So I felt like that was definitely worth mentioning, even if not given a deep dive. So shout out to all of the Black public health pioneers that we mentioned today and the others that existed and worked on a better life for us today. And that concludes this episode of the Hood Health Report.
So this is a wrap for this episode. I hope y'all enjoyed it. You can follow us on Instagram, which is Hood Health Report, as well as Facebook and Twitter, Hood Health Pod.
We also have a TikTok page now, Hood Health Report. Follow us there.
Yeah.
Don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel. All of the links will be in the descriptions, in the bios for you to click on.
Tap, like, comment, do it all.
Subscribe. All of the things. Share it with a friend.
Yes.
Share it on your social media.
If you have a TikTok, make a little video, send it.
Let us know you're out there watching, guys.